This is episode number 153 of the Fearless Presentations podcast, the fastest, easiest way to eliminate public speaking fear.
Want to absolutely eliminate public speaking fear? This podcast is the answer. Here's the guy who literally wrote the book on fearless presentations, Doug Stannert.
Everybody, welcome back. My guest today is Cody Lowry. Cody has been a successful marketer for 30 years, and he's built a multi-million dollar ad agency from scratch. However, one of the things he's best, or actually he's known for a couple of things, really. First, he's a best-selling author of a book called Schmooze, you know, what they should teach you at Harvard Business School, but I don't think they do. And it's really funny and very useful to business folks. But he's also pretty famous for getting invited to meetings that tend to be pretty hard to get with people. So I'm sure he'll kind of tell us about a few of those during the episode. So welcome, Cody.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. So when we're recording this, is like the day after the big Super Bowl where Tampa Bay and Tom Brady came back, and you're from the Tampa area, right? So I'm sure you guys are probably pretty excited. It's like all of professional sports, I think. I think this is the first time in that I can remember anyway, that a city has kind of swept a lot of the major sports, and Tampa's having a hot year. I don't think they want COVID to go away, right?
All we need now, Doug, is a basketball team.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. But I don't think the NBA owners are going to be really keen on that after you guys have cleaned up in every other sport. So
there you go.
No, so tell us about yourself, Cody. So tell us about your history, because you've kind of got an eclectic, unique. You're kind of like me. You got some diverse backgrounds. I know you kind of started out at least one point in your career. You were a comedian and somehow got into marketing and all that kind of stuff. So tell us kind of the shortened version of how you got to where you are.
Yeah, well, great question. I in 2017, and I'm president of an agency up in Birmingham, Alabama, and their president of their retail division. And I was, talking to the couple of guys up there, and we were bannering back some things, some experiences. And I've had an incredible journey. The journey isn't over, but setting up a meeting with the president of the United States in 1 week, getting a baseball signed by the Pope, being the recipient of a Super Bowl ring from one of NFL's Hall of Fame coaches, carrying the torch in the Olympic. I also auditioned for Saturday Night Live. And while the auditioning isn't really the story is that I pulled it off in about 48 hours. And it's a great story. And in the book, so I came up with the title Schmooze, what they should teach at Harvard Business School. And when I look at so many of the younger generation today, they're buried in their phones. Their social skills are lacking. And let's face it, we live in the most connected society in the history of the world, and yet we're more disconnected now than ever before. Yeah. And I think what Schmooze does, and I gave you some sizzle copy points. I've actually redefined the word schmooze. Schmooze comes from the Yiddish word schmooze, which means to chat idly in a friendly or persuasive manner, so as to gain, friendship and business or connections. And what I've done is I've taken my life. It's not a biography, but it's things that have happened in my life. And in the book, I mean, I address overcoming adversity and the importance of persistence. And then chutzpah is the new charisma. And if you look at leaders, great leaders, they all have a bit of that chutzpah, right? Right. It's about being kind to others. It's about, they have actually identified 25 different attributes of schmooze in the book. And, it's about having fun. But I think just to sum it up, it's about going through life with a great bedside manner. And that has allowed me to open doors and do all kinds of different things. So I came out with the book if you'll indulge me, you know, everybody's got a rags to riches story. Mine's quite unique. It is a riches to rags story. My mother and father came from well-to-do families in Detroit. My mother was actually raised with a lot of the automotive families, the Fords and the Fishers. And, you know, she did her debutante. She went to finishing school and she met my father, was with a, you know, he was with a furniture company. Well, something happened along the way there, Chris. They fell in love. They got married and they moved to Florida when I was about 5 years old. And whatever, you know, inheritance, money, whatever, they lost it very, very quickly. My dad would spend money on this, spend in this investment, that investment. And the next thing you know, they are both really good at drinking, okay? And they both become alcoholics. My dad leaves. And my mom, God bless her, Doug, she is, she's never worked a day in her life. And now she's got to raise four kids. And, you know, and within a 7 year period and 7 mile radius, we moved 32 times, oh, 32 times. I don't know if that's a Guinness Book World Record. I did run into a lady at a book signing not too long ago, and she actually lived in 22 places. But we moved because it was cheaper than paying the rent. You know, we used to have the electric turned off. My favorite saint was Saint Vincent de Paul, because I knew he would be there at Christmas time. Right. But the whole point of the story is my mother instilled in all of us that, you know what, we don't have anything right now. And I think this is kind of a BS line, but it, you know, and once she had a few, you know, drinks, you know, it sounded good to her. She goes, "You kids have blue blood running through your veins and you can do anything." And right. Blood and so we did. And myself at an early age, you know, I sold papers, you know, and, sure. And I think that's where I developed a lot of my personality. I developed persistence. I realized then that no doesn't necessarily mean no. When people would walk by, I'd say, "Miami News, sir, Miami News, ma'am." And they keep walking by. And I'd say, "Sir, would you buy a paper if I told you where you got your shoes, what state you were born in, and how many birthdays you've had?" Well, you know, for a nickel right. And you're 11 years old, you can get away with that stuff. They turn around and almost 100% of them would say, "Okay, I'm in." And I'd say, "You got your shoes on your feet. You were born in the state of infancy and you've only had one birthday the day you were born." And I'd get a nickel for and of the nickel, I got 2 cents. So, you know, I had a really hustle. Right. And I think that's where
it takes a long time to get wealth that way. So,
yeah. So that's kind of my early life. And, you know.
Nice. Yeah. So how did you get into advertising? Because before that, because I know that you and I spoke earlier and you kind of talked a little bit about your early days as a comedian. So was that your first gig? When was that?
You know, I was born with a lampshade on my head. Right. Unfortunately, I wish, you know, everyone was, because I think humor is great. And, life is short and you got to have fun. Right.
Yep.
So, I was, you know, the class clown, and then that developed to more sophisticated kind of things. I was the MC, and when I was in college, I was involved in these speech productions and, you know, did very well at them. And, sure. And then I got into the automobile business, and that's another story, but I just decided that really wasn't what I wanted to do. And I wanted to give comedy a shot, and I thought I could do it. Back then, Doug, they didn't have like regular venues where you would go and actually learn your craft and make a buck. I mean, for the most part, you may have gotten an honorarium, but that was rare and you worked for nothing. So
right.
My wife and I, we made the decision that I would give it a go. And I bounced around a little bit. My first paid gig was hilarious.
Well, I hope so. You were getting paid for it.
Sorry. Yeah, I was. And that's
okay. That's my only joke today, I promise.
No. Please don't upstage me. Okay. So we decided that we were probably going to move to Las Vegas. And that's where I really was going to learn my craft. I had a lot of raw talent, but to be very honest with myself, it was raw. But before I decided to go to Las Vegas, I decided I want to give New York a try. So with very little funds, I head off to New York City. And at the time, you know, they had the Improv, which was on iconic. They had Catch a Rising Star, which was, you know, the most popular comedic venue in the world. Every big name comedian came through those two venues. So I went up and I actually got on at Catch a Rising Star. And that was that's a different story altogether. But now I've got about 2 days left, right? I'm thinking, well, what can I do while I'm up here? You know, I've been to the two venues, I've done those. So you know what? I'll audition for Saturday Night Live. Right. Well, it's like, oh, I'll get a haircut, or oh, you know what? I'll audition for Saturday Night Live, which really, sure, to anybody with any knowledge at all at the time, they would have given me advice that, hey, don't go down that avenue. That'll take months or whatever. So sure. The next morning I called the offices of Catch a Rising Star, and I got through to a secretary, and I asked for specifically the talent coordinator. And this guy's name was John Head. He was an English chap. And I think a buddy of Lauren Michaels and what have you. So I asked for him. Guess what? I get him on the phone.
Oh, my God.
And yeah. And so I tell him about myself, you know, and I'm a comedian from Tampa, Florida. And, you know, I'm an impressionist. And by the way, I do Jimmy Carter. And Jimmy Carter just might end up being our next president. And I don't think Rich Little does. You know, Jimmy Carter, by the way, for the folks out there, my name is Jimmy Carter. Always tell the truth. If I ever tell a lie, I don't know the truth, you know. So in any event, I got his attention.
That's funny because like I suspect that there are probably people out there listening to the podcast right now going, who the heck is Jimmy Carter?
Oh, I know. Little,
right? He's still alive. I come from your generation, so I know. So.
Yeah, still alive, still charging 92 or something, but let people out there know that he was a president. So in any event.
Yeah, there you go. Hey, we just did our historical moment here on the podcast. So yeah, perfect. Good. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. So you got this call. What happened on the call?
Yeah. So he says, listen, he said, give me a call tomorrow. I'm really busy now and so on and so forth. And I didn't realize it at the time, Doug, but he was giving me the proverbial brush off, right? So I next day I call him once, and throughout my book, the your audience will see how persistence, not with just leaders but all of us, is so very important. I called him once, twice, I called him three times, called him four times. I was wearing his secretary out, right? I didn't get through to him, and I'm thinking, wow, I mean, I just thought this was a done deal. So what I did was, this is before the advent of the cell phones, I looked up his name through information, and sure enough, there's a John Head in Long Island. And, you know, it's about 7 or 8 o'clock, and I give him a call, and he answers the phone. And I said, Mr. Head, this is Cody Lowry. And there's this pause. He's not nearly as excited as I am, right? There's this pause on the phone, and he goes, you are unbelievable. And I said, well, I said, you know, I'm only here for another day. And I said, he said, look, come on by tomorrow and, you know, at a designated time, and let's see what you got. So I got to tell you, I think all of us get a little nervous, and I know you're in that speaking arena, and I think being nervous is good for a lot of reasons that I won't get into, but I got to tell you, going up that elevator at Rockefeller Center, I was so nervous. You know how sometimes you get so nervous, you get cotton mouth. You can't.
Oh yeah.
And I'm going, what am I doing? Going, well, this is crazy, you know, because again, you know, I knew I had the raw talent. I knew that I could take this to the next level, but I had no business auditioning for Saturday Night Live. With that said, the elevator opened, and I felt, wow. I mean, there was this calm that came over me, went up to the secretary. She rushed me into a room, and they didn't have really a stage. It was kind of like a platform. And he comes in, and he's just the nicest guy, you know? And, he says, well, let me see. He actually was an English chap. And he said, let me see what you got. So I get up there and I'm doing, I've got a, at the time I had a great routine on a fast cell vasectomy for $14.95. And, and it was funny. And it was, you know, saying vasectomy at the time, I mean, it was like saying the F word, you know,
right.
And got all kinds of crazy reactions. I did Jack Webb. I did John Wayne. I did all the standard stuff. And then I got into my Jimmy Carter and I went through the routine. And as I was looking out there, I was a little surprised that he was the only one in the room. But I went through the Jimmy Carter, which was a little bit more than what I just gave you there.
Sure.
And he wasn't rolling in the aisles, you know, during my time on that platform, but he was grinning from ear to ear. And I could tell that he genuinely liked me. Right. Yeah. And so when I was done with the Jimmy Carter, he said, "Hold that, Cody. I want you to share that with two other people." So two other gentlemen came into the room. I wasn't formally introduced, but I suspect one of them was Lauren. Right. And he says, "Do the Jimmy Carter routine." And so I did the Jimmy Carter routine, and they apparently loved it. They got out, they did something like that. And,
yeah.
And they were gone. And he said, "You nailed Jimmy Carter, Mr. Head did." And I said, "Well, I'm glad you liked it." He said, "Look it. If he becomes president," he said, "let's get back together." He said, "but, you know, it's going to be, you know, several months and what have you. And I'll catch you around town," is what he said. And he couldn't catch me around town because I was going back to Florida. Right. And but, you know, what I try to point out in that particular chapter, and it's more than just the auditioning for Saturday Night Live. You know, it's about stepping outside your comfort zone. It's about, you know, doing something that is really a wow that, you know, you want to do. And then, you know, having the courage to do it. So, going up and auditioning for Saturday Night Live was a big moment in my life.
Hey, so let me ask you a question about that. Because I'm looking at this from an independent third party kind of seeing. So after that moment, you decided to go to Las Vegas and kind of perfect your craft. And I'm sure while you were in Vegas, you probably got better and better and better. Do you think today, looking back, you know, hindsight's 2020, do you think today, would you have had even a better result if you had done that persuasive, that schmoozing with Mr. Head after you'd spent some time in Vegas, or was that the thing that got you to the next level that made you kind of go on to do the Las Vegas thing?
You know, even today I have a personality of, you know, I never really think about whether I can or can't do something. You know, if there's something that I want to do, I do it. There's a chapter, it's be a contrarian. And how many times, Doug, have you sat in a room with, you know, people that are getting along by going along and they're nodding their head and what have you, and they're going left and you're going, you know what, we need to go right. And so, you know, I speak about that. So I don't think I'm wired terribly differently, you know, maybe a little crazy on the comedic side, but I think to be a contrarian is something that is learned. And I think that great leaders are contrarians, right? You look at Fred Smith with the FedEx, right? I mean, he bet everything at Vegas and he couldn't make payroll, but he went and took $50,000 and went to Vegas, and you know the rest of the story. He won. He came back. He made payroll. He got his loans. He, you know, so being a contrarian is very, very important.
Yeah, I call that the maverick mentality. I mean, I think we find that a lot in entrepreneurs, and it's weird because I think some of it has to do with we mavericks kind of think so different from everybody else that we're unemployable. You know, we go work for somebody else and it drives us nuts and we want to do things differently and kind of go against the grain and that kind of thing. But it's what's funny is that although that's kind of your personality and that's what you like to do, when you're schmoozing, when you're being persuasive, you're doing the exact opposite, it seems, because you're using great people skills. And like, I think you called it the bedside manner. You know, that is one of the things I think that makes more people successful more than any other thing that they have is their ability to get along with folks and influence them and build that trust and build that rapport and get people to like them. Because when all other things are the same, you know, you go and get the same degree, the same piece of paper, you know, once you have that piece of paper, now you're judged on totally different things. You're judged on how well you can communicate and how well you can persuade people and how well you can win people to your way of thinking and how well you can get things done, get other people to get things done and that kind of thing. So that's
so important, Doug, because in the book, throughout, it's about building relationships. And I talk about the secret sauce, you know, build the relationship, get the customer to trust you, and then endeavor to never let them down. We have customers on the books for over 30 years, which in my segment, automotive retail, is almost unheard of. Okay. Right. And I think to the reason for the success is, you know, I know how to build relationships and I know how important it is. And I also know how important it is for this younger generation to build relationships. And it's hard to do that with more clicks and more shares. You know, you almost have to get out and be one-on-one. And hopefully we're going to get to a time where, you know, the COVID-19 is going to be behind us and we can all get out there, you know, like we did in the most recent future.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Hey, let me get your advice on some of the stuff that's in your book that is, you know, kind of helpful to folks that are, you know, maybe they, a lot of the folks that listen to the podcast, they're starting to speak more. Maybe they don't speak as often as what maybe we need to in order to really build up the series of successes where the confidence really grows. So, because it sounds like a lot of the stuff that you did, you were terrified when you did it, I would guess. But the energy and the enthusiasm that you had about that thing kind of overcame that terror or that nervousness. And I'm assuming that you've got some tips to kind of help folks. So if somebody's at a crossroads in their life or their career, and they have the ability to go out and do something different, but man, I've got the bills and I've got all these responsibilities and I've got a little bit of security here. Okay. Yeah. It's not where I want to be, but you know, what are some of the tips that you can give them to kind of give them that courage to go out and do the next big thing in their life?
Yeah. I would say that it's real important that they, and I address this obviously in the book, but you know, so many people they fear other people. They're scared of engaging. It's something they're uncomfortable with. They'll sit in the meeting. They might have the best idea in the world, but they, you know, they clam up, they don't say anything. And the fact of the matter is, Doug, is that we are 99% more alike than we are different. Yeah. And I think people are, you know, they're just scared of engaging, you know, other people that they work with, or maybe it's the boss, or maybe it's a new client. As I said, there are no pockets in a shroud, right? And that's an old Irish proverb. And so, you know, when the day finally comes, and we're all there. I mean, you know, and all we have is our wealth. I mean, that's nothing, you know? Yeah. So I think that's important. I think another thing that, and there's some real basics about, it's about a winning smile. And in chapter two, I talk about, you know, making that part of your daily repertoire and how that's really helped me. Right. And you see it, you probably see it a lot, Doug. I mean, in your profession where, you know, people just don't smile. I mean, so, you know, that's part of it. It's about making a great first impression.
Sure.
You never get a second chance to make a great first impression. I think especially, I just was interviewed on the Dallas affiliate, and we were talking to millennials specifically and job interviews vis-a-vis Zoom and what have you. And even though it's virtual, I mean, you still have to look the part. You have to make sure that that person sitting across from you, you know a lot about that person, not just that, you know, he's the guy that's hiring you or he's the CEO or whatever. So, you know, that's part of it. And I think to get started in the schmooze world, you know, you got to pay attention to the basics, and then, And then another one of them is to, try to start each day with, a laugh or, something that puts you in the kind of mood where you feel like charging.
Sure. Yeah. I know that when I'm kind of helping people organize presentations and that kind of thing, the starting point is always really going in and finding out as much as you can about the audience that you're presenting this to. Find out what they want. What is their problem? And then you become the problem solver for that person. You do that and they're going to welcome you with open arms because they're people just like we are. It was funny. I heard a radio psychologist. My wife likes to listen to people call in with their problems on the radio and
right,
that kind of thing.
Right.
And then we were driving around, that was on in the background, and she said something really profound. This radio psychologist, she said something really profound. Because the person that she was talking to had a self-confidence problem, I guess. And she said something really, really interesting to me. And I'm like, God, man, I'm going to steal that. So I'm going to kind of quote her for a couple of times. And then I'm going to totally steal this, because she said that everybody you meet, there are going to be some people that are absolutely smarter than you are. And there are going to be a lot of people that are absolutely not as smart as you are.
Yeah.
There are going to be people that are funnier than you are. And there are going to be people that are not as funny as you are. There are going to be people that are good at things that you are good at. And they may be even better at those things, but you're going to be better than a lot of other people, right? And so what she was saying was that when people try to compare themselves to other folks, that's where a lot of that nervousness and self-consciousness comes from. And I think one of the things that you said earlier was how your mom was telling you at an early age that, hey, you got the blue blood, you're special, you can do whatever you want to do. And I don't think a lot of people have had that when they're growing up. And so I think they grow up maybe thinking that, hey, I'm inferior to this other person, when in reality, well, in some cases, maybe that might be true, but certainly not in every case, and certainly not in the thing that you're the expert on. So the thing that you would be presenting on, or the thing that you would be speaking on, or the thing that people would ask your advice about, those are the things that you know better than that person. Otherwise, they'd be the person up speaking, right?
Absolutely.
So I think that gives people a lot of confidence when they start thinking that way.
I agree.
Hey, so a while back, you said a word that I don't hear very often. You said chutzpah. See, I can't even say it. That's how uneducated I am. So what exactly is that, and how does that help us be more successful?
Yeah, well, so chutzpah is the new charisma. Chutzpah is another Yiddish word. It means gall and nerve and, really doing some things, outside of the box for sure. You look at Sylvester Stallone, one of the most successful film icons in the world, right? And when you look at how he started out back in the 70s with, he had this script, Rocky, and he took it and tried to peddle. He didn't have a pot to you-know-what in.
Right.
And, the producers, they all liked the screenplay, but they didn't want him to play the role. They wanted Burt Reynolds or whoever to play the role.
Sure.
And they actually upped their ante to like $375,000. Sylvester Stallone, we like it. We'll give you this much. And this is 1976 or 75. Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
And he had the chutzpah to turn them down. And, the rest is history. They finally gave him the part. And he went on to be, this incredible, credible actor and star. And I think most people look at some of these people that are very popular in film or music or whatever, and they think, oh, they just walked on a stage and there it was. More times than not, they had to, dig deep and start using that chutzpah.
Right.
I'll tell you, here's a great story. I'm doing a commercial with Art Linkletter, and we're going to have to qualify that because there's people on the call who don't know who Art Linkletter was. But I had to fly out to California, and there was an earthquake, and they gave me the option of either staying in Florida or going. And I said, I'm going to go. And so I got to Los Angeles, and I was staying at the Marriott Marina Del Rey, And when I got there, the hotel was torn up. So they switched me over to the Ritz-Carlton. And I guess it was about, 1 o'clock when I got there. So I had some time to kill. And I was going to go down to Beverly Hills Rodeo Drive. For your listeners who don't know anything about Rodeo Drive, probably and arguably the most expensive, exclusive, you know, shopping street in the world.
Right.
And I get down there and there's hardly anybody there because of the earthquake, but the stores are open. Right. Sure. So I'm walking down and I see this men's clothing store. I had no business even looking in the window, much less walking in and, you know, right, messing around with their inventory. So anyway, it's called Bernini's of Beverly Hills. And I go in and I see all these expensive sport coats and suits and, you know, these silk shirts and what have you. And I realize that, you know, I'm definitely in the wrong place, but I see a rack in the back and it's 40% off. So I go back there and there's a reason stuff is 40% off, right? Yeah, it probably needs to be 80% off. So I kind of waltz back up to the front and I see this jacket. It's a cashmere and a wool jacket. It's a Hugo Boss. And it is I've never seen a jacket that appealed to me like this one did. And a young man comes up to me, may I help you, sir? He said, would you like to try that? And I said, no. And I'd looked at the price. It was like 600 and something, which was way, way, way above my threshold. You know, I was more in the $89 deal, you know,
right, sure.
Try to make it look as good as I could. So I said, no, I said, but I got a question. I said, is there any way I could get 40% off of this jacket? And he looks at me, he goes, no, sir. He said, but we do have a 40% discounts in the back. And I said, no, I've already been there. I said, I really like this jacket. Are you sure they won't knock 40% off? And he goes, I don't think so. He says, but I'll ask. So he goes over to the front counter and his manager is on the phone and he's talking. He interrupts and puts his hand over, you know, the speaker. And I can't tell exactly what they're saying, but he kind of shoos. He says, like, you know, get him out of here, you know.
Right.
So he comes up. He said, no, sir. He said, my boss said we can't do that. And I said, well, listen, I'm going to be around town for a couple more days and maybe I'll come back in and I'll get it. I was never going to walk in that store again in my life.
No.
So I walk out, I'm about a block and a half away. And here comes this kid, Mr. Lowry. And I turn around and there he is. He catches up to me and he's out of breath. And he said, sir, I talked to my boss and I told him that you probably wouldn't be back. And he said, he'll knock 40% off of that jacket. I said, really?
Oh,
so
yeah,
even at 40% off, it was way more than I wanted to spend on the jacket, but that jacket sits in my closet today and I can still wear it. And and I love it. So that's a little chutzpah, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you have to ask to get, right?
Yeah. I'm going to give you one more.
Okay, good. Okay.
Great story. I'm in Columbia, South Carolina. It's about 10:30 at night. The plane was late. I get in and I walk into the Marriott Hotel in downtown Columbia, South Carolina. And there is a line that looks like something you would see at Disney World. I'm going, what is going on here? And I found out through somebody in line that, you know, they're overbooked and they're putting people on a bus and they're sending them off to the embassy suites. Well, I'm kind of smiling on the inside because I have a guaranteed confirmed Marriott Marquis reservation. Right. And what that means is that they can't, if I have a reservation, I'm staying there, right? So I'm a little smug about it, actually. I'm thinking, oh, are these people crazy? They don't have a guaranteed reservation. So by the time I get up to the front desk, I said, Cody Lowry, and he was the night manager. Yes, Mr. Lowry. He says, well, we're overbooked tonight. We're going to put you right over in the embassy suites and it's no problem. And there's a rate difference. We're covering it, blah, 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 you know? And I said, yeah, but I have a confirmed guaranteed reservation. He said, well, that doesn't matter tonight. He did, you know, he probably been told that five times that night.
Sure.
And he said, you know, this is kind of like the airlines and they overbook all the time. And I said, no. I said, this isn't like the airlines. I said, I'm going to spend the night in this hotel tonight. And I said, who's the general manager of the hotel? And this is where the chutzpah comes in, right? I said, who's the general manager of the hotel? And he gives me this German name that, I mean, I couldn't even pronounce it. Mm-hmm. And I said, do you have his telephone number? He said, no, I don't. I don't have his number, blah, 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 blah. And I said, well, give me the spelling of his name again. So he gives me the spelling of his name. I take my cell phone and I move myself out of the way so he can tend to other customers. But he can hear what's going on. And I ask for information for this German name, right? Well, if there is one in town, there's only one. Right. It's not like, you know, a typical German name. And sure enough, he's got a number. I call him up. I get him on the phone and I said, I'm in your hotel right now. And you probably know the situation. They're moving everybody out to the embassy suites. And I got to tell you, I've got a confirmed guaranteed reservation. And I'm going to do one of two things. Number one, I'm going to find a way tomorrow morning to get a hold of Bill Marriott's assistant or whoever. And I'm going to let him know how I feel about this. And number two, which I will do, I will sleep in your lobby tonight. I'll sleep over on a couch not too far from this desk. I said, but I'm spending the night right here. And he goes, let me speak to, you know, whatever the gentleman's name was. And he hands, and the guy grabs my cell phone with kind of a, you know, he's a little upset that I even called his boss. And he grabs the phone and he goes, yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And it gets lower and lower. And finally hands me the phone and he looks down at the computer. He said, we're going to put you in 425 tonight. And I thought, well, that's great. That's exactly the room that I wanted to stay in. And you can have too much chutzpah where, you know, it really takes on a negative tone to a whole situation. So you got to, you know, it's part of your repertoire, but you don't want to, you know, use it every waking hour. Right. But when you're right, you're right. You know, and in that case, I was right. And, you know, I used a little chutzpah, which I said is a new word for charisma.
There you go. But I think you missed out because like Embassy Suites has those fantastic breakfasts, you know, like you have to cook the order breakfast.
It was 10:30. I'd been in another city and I was absolutely.
I'm exhausted, tired. Yeah. Yeah, well, good deal. Well, okay. Well, I love that you've kind of pulled a few of those stories out of the book to kind of share with us. Hey, if you're interested in the book, folks, Schmooze, What They Should Be Teaching You in Harvard Business School, you can find that on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, any place where you can buy a book, you can get this book anyway. So, Cody, thanks a lot for being a part.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Thank you for having me on.
You bet. All right. We'll see you guys next week. Bye, y'all.
Subscribe to this podcast for new public speaking secrets each week.